Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. We're going to get down to business today in a very interesting kind of way. We'll start the show learning about the Vermont Professionals of Color Network and an interesting project that they've launched. We'll then get an insight into the children's book business. Meet author and illustrator Jason Chin, recently named the winner of the prestigious Caldecott Medal. And at 10 o'clock, Linda Radke shares the story she recently wrote for the Montpelier Bridge about women-owned businesses in Waterbury. And we'll finish the morning with a half hour of open phones. But let's start the morning learning about the Vermont Professionals of Color Network. Joining me now is the board chair and co-founder of the organization, Tino Rutenhira. Tino, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you very much, Rick.
You're welcome.
It's been a pleasure to be with you.
It's great having you. Listeners, to ask Tino about the network and about locating BIPOC-owned businesses in Vermont, you can give us a call at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Tino, what is the Vermont Professionals of Color Network?
Yeah, so the Vermont Professionals of Color Network, or VTPOC, was founded in Burlington in January of 2019. We were formed initially to provide a support network for black and brown professionals and businesses. However, as we started kind of meeting as an informal networking group, we started discovering that, you know, there was a lot of needs and unmet things that needed to be resolved for the BIPOC professional community. And so the organization has actually kind of grown and morphed from that. And so really sort of our goal now is to build opportunities to improve the experience, representation, and success of BIPOC professionals and businesses in the state, and to usher in a new era of professional mobility for BIPOC professionals.
What were the needs, the gaps that you saw as the organization started to form?
Well, you know, there's a lot of things, actually. We discovered that, for example, we're an apolitical organization. Mm-hmm. We're not lobbyists or affiliated with any political party, but we do believe that racism is deeply ingrained in our society, and as a result, is deeply ingrained in our workplaces, too. And so we believe that systems that are failing communities of color are failing not just black and brown people, but white people as well. And so the goal of the organization is to eliminate the economic and professional gaps that exist between white people and people of color, because prosperity starts with opportunities to climb the economic ladder, and a prosperous BIPOC community is a good thing for all of Vermont. And so we realized, like, very quickly that there were many gaps, whether we're talking about BIPOC professional development or young people coming into graduating from college into the workforce, you know, coming in with little to no experiential opportunities or experience. And then also the support that comes with entrepreneurship and owning BIPOC businesses. You know, we want BIPOC businesses to go beyond being mom-and-pop shops, to go beyond being sole proprietors, and for them to become large employers and to get contracts, government and private sector contracts, in order to build their businesses and to grow from being a one-person shop to a two-person, five-person, 10-person shop.
Yep.
So those are just two, three really quick examples. I mean, but obviously this is a very, very detailed and deep discussion that we can potentially get into.
Well, Tino, do you have different chapters around the state, or do you meet in different locations to include members from different areas?
So we don't have different chapters throughout the state. We just have the single chapter kind of covering the entire state of Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
We do virtual events. Unfortunately, obviously, a lot of our members are in the Chinling County area, and we've done some in-person events here. That's kind of where we were founded and where a lot of our board members are. But we do appeal to the entire state of Vermont because one of the challenges, too, is the fact that there's a lot of BIPOC people that are in some of the outlying counties, you know, like Rutland County, Addison County, you know, the Lamoille Valley, wherever. And we don't want them to feel alone. We don't want them to have that sense of, I am just out here, an island, not really having any connections or community. We are trying to make sure that that changes for people so that they know that there is a community of BIPOC professionals that are experiencing the same challenges that they are, that have the same aspirations that they are, that maybe may be able to answer some of the questions and to help that they may have, and to help sort of with some of the career advancement challenges that we face as BIPOC professionals. Because if we try to do this as individuals, then, you know, we're not going to get very far. But we also want to make sure people know that, yeah, there might not necessarily visibly be a lot of BIPOC professionals around you when you look in an office or in a meeting or some conference that you're in. But we are out there. And what we're trying to do as an organization is to kind of coalesce and aggregate everybody so that people don't feel isolated.
Well, what type of events or activities do you put on to do just that, Tino?
So we go from very basic stuff like a monthly newsletter that features people within the BIPOC community that keeps everybody sort of engaged at a kind of very basic level to make sure people know that, you know, there's leaders out in the community, there's entrepreneurs out in the community, etc. So that's our newsletter. And then we also have a very active social media presence on Facebook, on Instagram, and also on LinkedIn. And we post there on a daily basis. So anybody who's kind of into the sort of social media space can keep up with everything that's going on. We highlight individuals. We post about things that are going on in the community. We post about job opportunities, etc. So there's a lot of just activity stuff that's happening on the social media space. And then obviously we have our website, which is a hive of information. There is a jobs board that's on there, so people can keep up with some of the jobs that are being made available, and I can go into detail about how that came about. And then additionally, we also have a BIPOC business directory for BIPOC businesses to list their businesses there, and for people that want to support BIPOC businesses to look up those BIPOC businesses. And then we also do virtual events. That can range from anything. We last year did a financial literacy kind of networking event where we brought in people to kind of educate our members about financial literacy, because it's one thing to advance the prosperity of BIPOC individuals in the state by getting them access to better jobs, etc. But once you've got that good paying job, or once you start to make a little bit of money, you want that money to start working for you. And in the white community, I think people have more or less mastered how to make money work for them and to get sort of generational wealth into their lives. We want the same thing for black and brown people in the state of Vermont. And then also we do just basic networking events where we just kind of host events for people to jump online, get to hang out and talk about just stuff going on, you know, to try and either advance our professional goals or to talk about different things that might be impacting us in the workplace or businesses that might be wanting to talk about how to progress a business, etc. So, and then we also then have in-person events where we've had large events. Last year, we had a summer gathering where we kind of, coming out of lockdown, we had a very large event attended by about 120 professionals that just kind of, it was a get-together, barbecue, really fun environment. We also had a number of other just smaller gatherings where we were talking about different things. So it really ranges, and I hope I've covered everything that did happen for people.
And does having this type of professional organization in Vermont send a message to others outside the state that there is an infrastructure that can help support them if they move here looking for a job, if they come to school here, graduate, look for a job?
Absolutely. I mean, I think when I think about Vermont, it is the second whitest state in the country.
Right.
So that is a fact. However, we want people to know that, you know, the fact that it is the second whitest state is probably a byproduct of the fact that we've never really tried to do anything to try change that kind of situation. So we get people or students that come here for college, and maybe you're at Middlebury College or at Norwich or somewhere, you know, where you're not maybe necessarily, say, at UVM, for example, mm-hmm. but out in the sort of more rural areas, there's probably not a lot of a big community of BIPOC individuals that you can kind of stay connected with.
Right.
And therefore, when you finish your college, you graduate, there's probably nothing that incentivizes you to stay in the state. You probably want to go back to where you came from. However, if we created an environment where people feel welcome and people feel connected, they might be more likely to stay. I usually say that Vermont has a marketing problem around sort of it being very white and et cetera, because I think when people think about Vermont, you know, they kind of think about it in a negative sort of, Vermont, like, ugh, it's cold, it's like super white, et cetera. But
right.
I think it's mainly because nobody's ever really tried to attract BIPOC people to the state. You know, you think about a place like Chicago or Detroit or Minneapolis, St. Paul, those places are probably temperature-wise on average just as cold as Vermont.
Sure.
So you cannot tell me that it's because it's cold in Vermont. They've got thriving BIPOC communities in those areas. And then you also then have young white couples or families coming and relocating from the Boston suburbs and from metro cities like New York City and Philly. They're all coming to Vermont. What are they attracted to? They're attracted to the quality of life. They're attracted to the, you know, the environment, you know, the open spaces, etc. They're attracted to the safety. They're attracted to, you know, maybe if they're coming to Burlington, you know, kind of a city that punches way above its weight in terms of size comparative to other cities that are even bigger than itself, et cetera. So we can make the same case for BIPOC individuals that are not in the state of Vermont, because BIPOC people also want to have safe places to live. They also want to have great schools to send their kids. They also like the lake and the mountains and the skiing and all of that stuff. We just have to make that case for them that, hey, Vermont is an attractive place. And as a BIPOC organization, we are putting ourselves in the position where we can now speak to them directly rather than maybe perhaps a white recruiter saying, hey, come to Vermont. You know, it's a really cool place for BIPOC people. And yet, you know, they don't really hear from a BIPOC person.
Very interesting. Tino, where did the idea come from to create this BIPOC business directory?
Well, it came about just because we needed visibility for our BIPOC entrepreneurs and organizations. A lot of our members who own businesses, you know, are sort of stuck in this rut where nobody really knows who they are, nobody's are supporting them. And when sort of the whole George Floyd thing happened and people wanted to come out and really kind of address systematic racism, one of the things that came was a byproduct of that was that people realized that, you know, there was this need to try and support BIPOC entrepreneurs and their businesses. And so, yeah, we just decided, you know what, let's put together a database of BIPOC businesses and make it easy for people who want to or choose to support BIPOC businesses to just find them and go and give them their business, I guess.
Yeah. And you say make it easy. It is technically nimble. I've used it several times now and found it very easy, to get around. How long did it take to put together? When did it actually launch?
We launched it in September of 2021. Uh-huh. Years are like all kind of bundled together now.
I know.
So last year in September, but it took us about maybe 3 or 4 months to kind of get everything we needed. It was kind of a slow burn because there is no established database out there. Even, you know, if you were to start your own business today and register with the Secretary of State, they don't ask you, is your business a BIPOC business or not?
Right.
So it's not like there's anything out there that tells you that an organization is or isn't. And so it was kind of difficult, but initially it was hard to just find people. And then as we started putting this thing together, people started coming forward with their ideas. And I would like to plug somebody who built it was a Google spreadsheet of businesses that maybe had about, I think, maybe 100 businesses or so. I don't know who that person was, just sort of started floating as this open Google sheet that businesses listed. And sort of that was our starting point. And then from there, we then just started calling up businesses that we knew and hitting people up individually.
Well, I'll tell you how it's worked for me. I had no idea there was a professional basketball team in Bennington, and so I found it on your website. I had the coach of the Bennington Martins on the show yesterday. Next week, I'll be broadcasting live in Randolph, and so I know where I'm going right after the show, because right next door to where I'm having the show is Kaya's Sandwiches in Randolph, and I might just stop off at Made in Brazil in Barrie on the way home, pick up some of their delicious steak. But these are businesses that I found on your site that I wasn't aware of. You know, they've just clued me in that quickly. And like I said, you go to a business and you get the map so easy to then locate it.
Yeah, actually, I did notice that Made in Brazil one day when I was kind of just looking around to see what's out there.
Yeah.
And I have made a conscious note because I do love my meat.
It sounds fabulous. The other thing is, you know, I'm pleased to see other businesses and artists like Kismayo Kitchen, one of my faves in Burlington, but artists like Ray Vega, Myra Flynn listed there. So how have you, you know, what have you done to make sure that you have included as close to everyone on the site who should be on the site?
So we have about 400 businesses listed today, and we think there's more. We think there's at least twice or three times as many businesses. It's just that we got to a sort of critical mass, and now we need word to get out to continue to get businesses to submit their names and put their names out there. And we don't want just, you know, like there's a lot of restaurants out there, and that's great. I love the fact that now I'm like my palate is being, I guess, improved or enhanced by the fact that there's quite a lot of restaurants. But we want, you know, I know there's a ballet studio that's out there. There's a brewery in St. Johnsbury.
Been there, yeah.
There's a consulting company in Barrie. There's a psychotherapist who's out in Middlebury, you know, event management and wedding planner out in Rutland. So we want yoginis, we want architects, we want lawyers, we want, you know, plumbers and electricians. Anybody who has a BIPOC business or at least is majority BIPOC owned. Sure, if you are a BIPOC person and maybe you have a white spouse or have a white partner and it's 50-50, your business is just as important to us as a business that's 100% BIPOC owned. As long as at least 50% or majority ownership is BIPOC, we want to support those businesses, because at the end of the day, that's really what we're here for, is to kind of put forward these black and brown entrepreneurs who are hustling every day just like everybody else.
Right.
But ultimately, what we want to try and do is grow those businesses, because if we can grow those businesses, then they become the next you know, Seventh Generations or Dinner.coms or SD Island of this place. You know, I always, I've got no evidence of this, so this is completely my own kind of made up thing. But I can imagine whoever started like SD Island back in whatever year that was, probably was this one guy who maybe perhaps was doing driveways or something, you know, and, you know, maybe at some point got lucky and got a nice contract that allowed him to then hire his second guy that could help him and maybe third guy. And then maybe then he got a contract with maybe a government contract that then guaranteed some revenue for 3 to 5 years or whatever. And then that allowed him to grow from a two-person shop to maybe a 10-person organization. And now everywhere you look, SD Island is there, anywhere where there's construction. That's what we want for our BIPOC individuals and businesses. And that starts with people recognizing that there is these opportunities for them.
And businesses growing like that help Vermont grow, and that's exactly what we all need. I do want to point out before I let you go, you kind of touched on this earlier, there are a couple Money Matter programs this weekend that you can find out about at the website. I'll give that address in just a moment. Taking place at North Branch Nature Center. Tino Rutenhira is the co-founder and the board chair of the Vermont Professionals of Color Network. Their BIPOC business directory is available at vtpoc.net. Tino, thank you so much for being on the show this morning.
Thank you very much. I don't know how much time I have, but I just want to put in a little plug. We are proposing a radical transformation of Vermont into a place where everybody wants to be and everybody wants to emulate. The sad reality is Vermont is dying from a literal and figurative perspective. We don't have enough people. Our population is getting older. We need to be able to attract people to the state. And what VTPOC is proposing to do doesn't require a 20-year plan. It's something that can be done in 5 years by just changing the way we're doing business in Vermont, by attracting BIPOC individuals to the
All right, Tino, I've got to let you go, but thank you so much. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. Sit down and read a book with a child, and you'll watch their eyes light up and their minds race as they take in the images on the pages. They hear the story communicated by you, and they drink in the lovely illustrations to make the connection between your narration and what they're able to understand. It's not always evident to us as we get older and focus more on the words rather than the artwork on the page. But for the young ones we read to, those illustrations are vital. And we have the opportunity to meet someone who understands the importance of everything that goes on the pages in children's books. He's a writer and illustrator and was just named as the recipient of the Caldecott Medal. Jason Chin joins us now. Jason, congratulations and welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Jason about his work, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Jason, was being a children's author and illustrator always your career goal?
It sort of was. I grew up in New Hampshire, and when I was in the second grade, a children's book illustrator who lived in our town came to my school to present her book. And I was a kid who liked drawing, and when she presented at my school, I was just amazed. She happened to have had won a Caldecott Medal, and I thought, wow, there's an award for art, and oh my goodness, maybe I could be an illustrator someday. So it was always kind of in the back of my mind. As I grew up, I continued to enjoy drawing. You know, I liked a lot of things, but that was kind of rose to the top of the things I liked. I liked making pictures. And so I went to art school, and I didn't go with the intention of becoming an illustrator. But one thing led to another, and I pursued it. So I sort of did have it in my mind, I guess, from an early age.
Well, I'm thinking of your story and wondering if you – when you go and visit a school or you're at a library and you're talking to children, if you're thinking, I wonder if there's the next Jason Chin that I'm going to inspire, someone who likes to draw and who sees me now a Caldecott winner, medal winner, and think, wow, that's what I would love to do.
You know, it would, that would give me the most, joy and satisfaction to know that I had helped another young artist on their way, and that would make me very happy.
Yeah.
And so I do visit a lot of schools, and I always try and give what I think would be useful advice and to young artists.
Yeah, well, you're going to inspire somebody. Do you do other artwork or design work, or are you just concentrated on writing and illustrating children's books?
Now I just do children's books.
Wow.
I do some personal painting, you know, some landscape painting. It's just when I can find the time for myself. I used to design websites, and I've slowly phased that out, and so now it's, you know, the vast majority of what I do is children's books.
Yeah. What is it that you enjoy about the work you do, Jason?
Boy, there's so many things that I enjoy. I'm really fortunate to have found this career, and not just a career as a children's book illustrator, but the specific kinds of books that I do. Typically, I write about science and nature, and so I get to follow my curiosity. I get to pick a topic, ask a question, and go try and find the answer, and then present that topic to a kid. I'm the kind of person that when I hear something really cool, like something really interesting about an animal or physics or I don't know. My interests are pretty wide.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, when I find something I'm interested, I want to tell people. So I'm always boring my kids and my wife with new facts that I've learned.
And they say, "Oh, just go write a book about it."
Yeah, exactly right. So, but I get to then go write a book about it.
Yep.
And dive deep and really get to understand the topic. So that's something I love. But my first passion is making pictures. So I get to explain things with pictures, and that's really, really satisfying. And I'm really fortunate to be able to do that as a career.
Now, Jason, I'm not sure how to tell you this, but do you realize that your book, Grand Canyon, has a Wikipedia page? But you personally do not have a Wikipedia page.
That's funny. I did not know that. I haven't looked for myself online very often.
Wow,
and that's so cool that the book has.
I know.
You know, I'm like a lot of authors. I think that I'd rather the books be up front and I'll just sit in the background. So that's great to hear.
Yeah. Well, tell us about Grand Canyon, which won a Caldecott honor.
Right. Grand Canyon is a book about the Grand Canyon, of course. When I made the book, I kind of asked the question, what makes the Grand Canyon really special?
Mm-hmm.
I got to, of course, go visit the Grand Canyon, and I worked with experts, geologists, and paleontologists and biologists that work in and around the canyon. And what I ended up doing was creating a book that tried to show the varied ecology in Grand Canyon. It's got this amazing variety of ecosystems and microclimates, but also the amazing geology and what we can learn about Earth's history at Grand Canyon. So the book follows a girl and her father who hike into the canyon, and they see the wildlife that's there, but they also see the geology, and through fossils, the girl gets to witness the past environments that existed as the rocks were being formed. So she weaves in and out of time and sees the whole, billion-year plus history of the rocks in the canyon.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty big book for a picture book, and it's got kind of a broad, it's expansive. But I guess I like to say is that it's a big book, but it's a big topic.
Yeah, you love big topics. You've done the Galapagos Islands. You've done gravity, coral reefs, redwoods. Anything you're currently working on?
Yeah, so the next book that will come out is coming out in the fall. It's called The Universe in You. It's a companion book to the last book that I wrote, which was called Your Place in the Universe. In that book, the reader zooms out to see the larger and larger things until we get to the largest thing we know of, the observable universe. In my new book, The Universe in You, the reader will be taken on a journey down the scale, down to the scale of cells and molecules and atoms, and to the smallest things we know, elementary particles, quarks, and electrons, and so forth.
Wow, that's excellent. Jason, how did the collaboration with Andrea Wang on Watercress come about?
Well, my editor acquired the manuscript and then asked me to illustrate it. And after I agreed, then he decided that Andrea and I should meet. Now, a lot of people don't realize that it's not normal for the author and the illustrator of a picture book to meet. Mm-hmm. Typically, I don't meet the authors of the books that I illustrate, at least until after the book is created. But in this case, the story was semi-autobiographical. It comes from Andrea's own childhood, and it is about her family and family history. So my editor thought it would be important for me to meet her, her to meet me, and us to get to know each other. And that was really important for me because it was so personal. I felt very hesitant about illustrating it, actually. And after I got to know Andrea and got to hear from her about her feelings about it, about her family story, I felt like I had permission in a way.
Yeah.
I felt more relaxed going into the creative process of making the art.
Tell us a little of the story of Watercress.
Well, Watercress is the story of a girl of Chinese heritage who is living in Ohio. She's growing up in Ohio in the mid-70s, and she feels like she doesn't fit in her community. She feels like she doesn't belong. So it's a story of identity, belonging, family, and hope. She, what happens in the story is that her parents see watercress growing in a ditch by the side of the road next to a cornfield, a drainage ditch, and they stop the car, and the whole family gets out to pick the watercress. And Andrea is so – I'm sorry, I said Andrea,
yeah.
The protagonist.
You're right.
This is based on Andrea's childhood, but
right.
The protagonist is a separate character. The protagonist, this
is why. This is why,
so
Jason, this is why we don't let you meet the authors, Jason.
That's right.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, she's embarrassed by her family. She doesn't want anyone to see her. She doesn't want to eat the food. She's embarrassed by her family's thrift, by her old hand-me-down clothes. And then she learns a bit of her family's history, and she comes to a better understanding of who she is and where she came from, and learns that she can be proud of who she is.
Yeah,
I think it's a quintessentially American story, really. And a lot of people that we've heard from, who've read it, from all walks of life, from all backgrounds, have said that, boy, this was their family's story.
Yeah.
And it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's interesting. Our parents' history as kids, we don't necessarily appreciate sometimes, their story before we became part of it, our parents. And then as we become adults, we wish we had asked them more about their lives. And this really kind of points to that, right?
Absolutely. I think this story, one beautiful aspect of it is that it will encourage kids to ask their parents about their story and their history. And there's a intergenerational communication in this story that I think a lot of people relate to.
Yeah. What kind of challenge does it present when you're working with another writer? You're not writing the book, you're the illustrator, compared to when you're doing both elements of a children's book.
Yeah, well, when I start a book that I've written, I can envision it from the beginning. As I'm writing the words, I start imagining pictures to go with them. But in the case where I'm illustrating another author's text, I have to read and interpret their text and spend some time getting into it, finding a way to make it personal to me, finding a way to relate to the characters and imagine myself in their shoes. So there's that process of interpretation that goes on. And actually being able to talk to Andrea was really helpful in that case. It helped me to understand how her parents felt about the situation. It helped me to understand, obviously, how she felt about the situation, although I think that came across very well in the text. Helped me to understand her relationship with her brother at the time, who kind of teases her in the book. And then I could make connections between her story and my life and people in my life. So it's really a process of empathizing.
Yeah. Well, Jason, they love you at the South Burlington Public Library. Let's hear what Library Director Jennifer Murray told WCAX.
Oh, it was a party here. Yeah, we were so excited. Having a local person is just thrilling. And we know Jason and his family, of course, because they use the library all the time.
Jason, that's great to hear. You know, I tell this story that I once heard someone say, you're a genius 30 miles away from home, but you're a genius right in your hometown. They really do know what they have there. But have you always been that kid hanging out at the library?
Yeah, the library and bookstores, too.
Yeah.
So when I grew up in a small town in New Hampshire, our school actually didn't have a school library, our elementary school. We used the public library, which was right across the street.
Mm.
And so I became very familiar with the public library like right away and the children's section there and spent a lot of time there. Later on, I'd spend time actually in high school, I'd go to the bookstore to hang around and look at the picture books and look at the art. So I've always kind of had an affinity for books and illustrated books.
How did you find out that you won the Caldecott Medal?
My editor called me on the Friday before it was announced to the public, and he said, Jason, I have a group of librarians I'm presenting to. We're doing this a video, an online virtual presentation, and I'm going to talk about your book. Would you mind popping on to tell them about the creative process and maybe hold up some of the art,
mm-hmm.
meaning presenting the next book to them. And I said, sure, it's kind of weird that you're doing it on over the weekend, but I guess that's when the conference is happening that these librarians are at. So I get on the call, and it turns out they actually didn't want to present me to present to them. They were there to present the Caldecott.
Oh, wow.
To tell me that they had selected me. So I look at the camera, and there's the committee, and boy, they recorded it. I think they have my reaction on video, and I haven't seen it. I'm a little embarrassed, but it was very special. It was quite a surprise. They really got it.
Well, it sounded like they were partying at the South Burlington Public Library. How did you celebrate the award?
Well, I tried to go out and buy some watercress to cook it, but it turns out that it's not you can't get it this time of year.
Oh.
They didn't have it at the grocery store, which I guess that makes sense. But kind of celebrated with my family and it was very nice. And then when it was announced on Monday, I had to keep it quiet until Monday, and then a lot of messages came in, and it was a nice day. We got together on Zoom with a bunch of friends and had some calls with family. It was nice.
And we've got about 30 seconds, but what does an honor like this mean to an illustrator?
Oh, it's amazing. From that very early age, I thought, boy, that's like the gold medal.
Yeah.
The Caldecott. At that time, I didn't know there were any other awards for art. And a lot of Caldecott artists and their books have inspired me over the years. I look up to them and put them on a pedestal and try and learn from them. And so to be able to count myself among their company is just, it's just amazing. It's the highest honor in a lot of ways. And, I am so grateful and, I kind of can't believe it. I'm getting used to it.
But. You've reached the pinnacle, Jason. Jason Chin.
it's all downhill.
Jason Chin is a children's book author and illustrator, now the winner of a Caldecott Medal. Jason, once again, congratulations, and thanks for joining us this morning.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on.
It was great having you. We're going to take a break for CBS News. Then we're going to return to hear about the tradition of women-owned businesses here in Waterbury. And coming up today at 1 o'clock, it's the full-blown three-hour version of The Getaway with host Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I walk down Stowe Street in Waterbury 5 days a week. It's a picture postcard in the winter months that feels like I'm in Bedford Falls in It's a Wonderful Life. But it wasn't until I saw Linda Radke's story in the Montpelier Bridge that the light bulb went on. I was walking past and patronizing a number of women-owned businesses all on the same street. Zoinks, right? And the tradition has its roots with a rose, but we'll get to that. Here to talk about Waterbury's female entrepreneurs is Linda Radke. Linda, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning, Rick. Great to talk to you.
Great to have you. Listeners, to ask Linda about some of Waterbury's women-owned businesses, you can call us at 802-244-1777. 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. It just closed, but there was an exhibit that ran for a few months at the Vermont History Museum in Montpelier called Waterbury Women, Stories and Inspiration. Tell us about that.
Well, it's amazing. The Waterbury Historical Society has done a lot of work on this historic district and went back 100 years to when women were trying to get the vote. We have a picture of a suffrage parade right around the corner from Stowe Street. And one of the signs interested me. It said, down with the tyranny of man. And it was from Shepley Coal. And Mrs. Rose Shepley took over the coal business when her husband died. And she was pretty much the only woman-owned business in Waterbury 100 years ago.
Wow.
So that kind of piqued my interest.
What role did women play on, like, the select board, the fire department in Waterbury's past?
Very active. And I think, you know, my perspective has been just in the last, say, 40 years, just seeing how women have contributed to this community, especially through all the difficulties we've had with, you know, 2011 with Irene and with all the construction and really building up the economic support here in town. And women have been really prime in that effort.
Tell us more about Rose Shepley, because she intrigues me.
Yeah, well, I want to thank Skip Flanders from the Waterbury Historical Society for teaching me more about this. I mean, of course, when Rose Shepley took over the coal business, women couldn't vote. I think they could vote maybe in municipal elections or maybe for a school board trustee or something, but not certainly in state or national elections. And so she just took it over and was well-respected as a business owner in Waterbury. And, of course, how essential was coal at that point for fuel. And she actually developed some new ways of using the trains and making it more efficient to get the coal to people in Waterbury. I wish I could have met her.
Yeah. Interesting, you know, the business she was in, because, you know, you might have thought, well, a female business owner 100 years ago might have owned something more soft, like a floral shop or something.
Sure.
Right? But a coal company.
Right.
And with the name Rose. It defies all, you know, explanation. But she also made you realize, like you made me realize, hey, Waterbury women are playing a major role in commerce in town. So explain that.
Yeah, that was news to me, too, because I go to Waterbury all the time. I taught in that district for 30 years. And it was lovely to see former students running businesses on Stowe Street. And then a friend of mine, also from Harvard Union High School, Sarah Page, said, did you realize they're mostly owned by women? And it didn't really occur to me. You know, maybe now we've made more strides, I think, in women in public life, so it just didn't connect. And then after this article came out, I found out through Facebook, there are a lot of businesses in Waterbury, not just on Stowe Street, but throughout the town, that are owned or co-owned by women.
Yeah, really a great thing to realize. So let's start around the corner from WDEV, and then we'll sweep up Stowe Street.
Okay.
But let's start with the lovely little pub, the Black Back. Tell us about
it. I know, and, you know, it really is Bedford Falls, Rick.
Yeah, it is, right?
It really is. I mean, especially in the wintertime, there's some
beautiful
photos by Don Hirsch, also a Harwood alum. And, you know, that beautiful little street, which used to be kind of dead, frankly. So you start with a Black Back pub, and it's doing so well when I dropped in the other day. It's a beautiful federal building right on the corner there. I remember there was kind of a Chinese restaurant there for a while, and now it's Lynn Mann and Dave Junker. And it's really, really popular. They bought the whole building. So now they have 22 employees and have work in the kitchen as well as in, you know, amazing amount of beer. I don't know if you stop by there at all.
Yes, I do.
The craft beers and also the sort of comfort food that they have. But what I was really excited about is looking upstairs at that space, which would be more fine dining, but also realizing how much work they're providing to locals.
Yeah. And, you know, that, as you mentioned, the beer, I can remember, I think it was the Boston Globe did a story about, you know, Waterbury's connection to craft beers. And it was, you know, across the street at Pro Pig, originally the Alchemist, and at Blackback. You know, Blackback was the first place around you could find things like Hill Farmstead, or you can get, you know, Sean Lawson's, you know, Double Sunshine. And, you know, it was that place. You got to go into Blackback to find out what you should be drinking.
But the other thing, Rick, for me is I've got this view of Waterbury from when I first arrived. So it was 1975, right there at the corner was a kind of sketchy place. I'm not sure. I can't remember what it was called. Maybe some listeners can call it. But, you know, as a young woman, I wouldn't go in there.
Interesting.
Yeah, and also right around the corner, I think the salon is now.
Yep.
Jody Green was talking to me about when she was a student and a young person walking through, and she couldn't understand why there was black paper all over the windows of that shop. Rick, it was a porn shop.
Oh, my.
And people could go around back because there's some parking there. Can you believe that? That was probably in the 80s.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
It was a pretty, you know, there weren't a whole lot of businesses that were thriving at that point.
Yeah.
So I've got to credit a lot of people. I mean, not only women, but just people in Waterbury who have so much local commitment, and especially Revitalizing Waterbury, which is an organization that really helped bring businesses back. I mean, we're finding people coming from Burlington who can't afford the rents there. Really fancy, beautiful companies like Tabitha Henry or the new cake shop, I think, right around the corner. And they're in Waterbury, and people are stopping by. So not only are locals are spending money locally, but visitors as well.
Yeah. All right. So we were at the Black Back. Let's turn the corner onto Stowe Street, and we're going to stop at Axel's Frame Shop. What's the history of this shop, and who's in charge now?
Oh, Axel Stolberg was the original, and he is an amazing artist. And eventually he sold it to Whitney Aldrich, and now they're not only a frame shop, but a wonderful gallery, and she has all kinds of exhibits there. And when I visited, people were buying work of local goldsmiths like Reagan Huff and a lot of other pop-up events. I mean, during COVID, it's been difficult, but she's kept it going. And the one thing Whitney offers is curating services. So if you've just bought a home or you're setting up an office and you'd like to have somebody help you to choose art for those spaces, she can do that as well.
Wow, that is fantastic. Well, next in line is WDEV. We'll skip us, and it's time to do a little eating. Let's go to Casey's Bagels, the next stop on our tour up Stowe Street.
You probably stop there every day, like I used to when I was at DEV.
I know.
So that's Kyle Russell and Buffy Garand, and they, you know, they are just the oldest. I think they're the oldest on Stowe Street. They've been around for a long time.
Yeah.
And, you know, for a while, I remember Kyle was talking about they had a cream cheese shortage. Can you imagine? During COVID.
Gosh. Goodness.
They have 13 flavors of cream cheese. And, of course, I go there for the coffee, but they also have a lot of other specials for breakfast and lunch. And I think the one thing about Casey's is a lot of locals come in, and they walk in the door, and Kyle will say, "The regular," and they'll say, "Yep," and there we go. Bacon horseradish, cream cheese on a salt bagel.
Yeah, and another comfortable place for people to sit down, have a bagel, have a coffee, and just relax there on Stowe Street.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of meetings, too, there. People are looking for meeting spots now that we're all working from home.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's continue our walk up Stowe Street, Linda. Now, alas, I'm bald, so I haven't had a whole lot of reason to pop into Lasting Image Salon, but tell us about Jody Green.
Well, again, for me, as a teacher at Harwood Union, I knew Jody. She graduated, I think, in the 90s, and she went away to study and to learn her craft, but always wanted to open a business in Waterbury, and so she did. And it's wonderful to see what happened, especially trying to negotiate, you know, during all the layoffs at Green Mountain Coffee Roasters and then the state workers coming and during the pandemic. And she has such a loyal clientele there. It's amazing. And she really cares about her clients. It's been fun to talk to her, too, as a local about all the changes in downtown Waterbury.
Yeah, what changes has she noticed most?
Well, of course, she used to walk through by the porn shop when she was a child.
Which is now her shop.
Now her shop. And also, she's seen, you know, the community come together to sort of help revitalize the town after Hurricane Irene and also, you know, all the construction we've had lately. the town has really improved, but it's been a challenge to keep the businesses open, especially if you're a hair salon. You can't do that from home.
Yeah, all the state workers, you know, who had been coming to work every single day here in Waterbury, and then Tropical Storm Irene comes and they're moved elsewhere in the state. That was a big knock for Waterbury, and like you said, the pandemic. So it's amazing. If you really kind of build it, people will come. If you create a beautiful town and have the right kind of mix of shops, people will come here. And one of those shops, as we saunter up Stowe Street, is the Stowe Street Emporium.
That's an amazing place. Whenever I walk in, I think about Jack Carter and Ted Schulheis, who started that Emporium many years ago, and I thought, really, is that going to work in Waterbury? And it was really, really thrived. And now it's owned by a husband and wife team, Kathy Murphy and Larry, but their daughter Kate as well is a co-owner. And it's like this little department store. And I would love to hear from any listeners who remember Luce's department store way back when. But when you go into Stowe Street Emporium, it just lifts my spirits. I mean, they're just all kinds of beautiful gifts and cards and things you wouldn't expect to find, local jewelry. And the other story, Rick, I think is wonderful, is these are people who had had another business for a while and never had done retail before, but they work really hard.
Yeah.
And when the pandemic shut everything down, they didn't have online shopping, which I think helped a lot of companies. So Kate Ruggles decided that they would deliver boxes. They call them mystery boxes to people's doorsteps. So you could just say, I'm looking for some kitchen stuff. And they would just, you know, get a bunch of material together and assemble them. And she had children at home, and they were helping her as well. And then they drove all over the state to deliver their mystery boxes. And I think that's just, you know, a wonderful thing for a business to sort of figure out a way to keep going.
Well, the other thing is, and I wonder how many times you've done this. I've done it at least a dozen so far since coming to work here. But when you need a gift, you just walk in and you walk out. I usually have more than I bargained for because I start buying things for myself as well. But it's that kind of place that inspires, right, when you're trying to
really
find
does.
A
it's
gift
colorful.
For somebody.
The windows are wonderful. I got to say, if you're ever blue, you just walk in there and read the cards. They just came back from a buying trip to Atlanta, and they're going to New York City later on, and just sort of keeping up with the trends as well. So I think locals go there certainly for gifts, and you don't have to go online, and you don't have to go to the big box stores.
Right.
And I think that's what people are learning, to keep your money local.
Yeah, and I always wander over to the chocolate section. they've got killer maple truffles over there and all kinds of great chocolates. So if you need a little sugar lift, that's the place. Now, I want to tell you another story about it. One morning I popped in there, and I was looking for a unicorn something for my niece's daughter.
I bet they had it.
They did not. And let me tell you what happened. Kathy said, I'm all out of unicorns. Go to Bridgeside Books and Success. And there I met another great shop owner, Katia D'Angelo, who's been a guest on our book show several times.
Mm-hmm.
But it's that kind of spirit, though, that kind of, you know, realizing if I don't have something, I'm going to send you to another shop right near me, right, to keep it right here in the family. Now let's go across to Bridgeside Books and tell us about the owners there.
Yeah, and I just stopped by the other day and I saw that they were having a date night at the bookstore, and I thought, how does that work? And you bring your date and there's like a scavenger hunt.
Oh,
so you go to the cookbooks and you find a recipe you'd like to try, or, you know, it's really fun the way that Katya has developed these programs to get people in. And I had no idea that you can rent board games.
Oh, nice.
I know. I mean, that's a big thing right now for families, and some of them cost $50.
Right.
And so it was wonderful to see that they do a lot for the community to have, you know, books for children for the Giving Tree. And it's wonderful. When they first started, though, Rick, I was a little skeptical. Again, I didn't didn't trust that Waterbury would come through on this, but Hayata Tordon was working for Green Mountain Coffee Roasters over at the train station, and it was always her dream to open a bookstore. And I thought, oh, my, everybody uses, you know, Barnes & Noble, everybody uses Amazon. How is this going to survive? I mean, Montpelier, we have one, but I didn't know. And she just took that chance and started it small. And I thought, you know, maybe a paperback exchange would work in Waterbury, but not hardcover books. It totally works.
Yeah.
She has authors coming in, and she really prioritizes in the non-book things, which every bookstore has to have just to make the profit. She has local stuff and not a whole lot of packaging and a lot of handmade things.
Yeah.
The other thing I love, because many people love bookstores, but here you can just go to the bookstore and then go up a little, go through a door, and you're at the Stowe Street Cafe.
Yes.
So you take your newly purchased book, and you get yourself a wonderful cup of coffee, and you can sort of talk to people there. So it's a lovely little place to spend some time.
Yeah. Tell us about the owner at Stowe Street Cafe.
Oh, that's an amazing thing, too, because it's Nicole Grenier, who is another local person. And this is a term I hadn't heard before, mompreneur. So instead of entrepreneur,
a mompreneur.
And she really believes in helping the community. So she has these gift certificates that you can buy. So your neighbors who depend on the food shelf can actually get money from you going to the cafe. And they've raised, oh, about $9,000, I think, for the ACLU as well, and social responsibility grants and things. So right now, Stowe Street Cafe has takeout. But when I get to go there in person, they have this one thing, Rick, you've got to try. It's the Roy G. Biv salad. Mm. It has all the colors of the rainbow.
Oh, my.
And also a local coffee, which is Brave Coffee, right from Waterbury. So, yeah, Stowe Street Cafe is wonderful. And during the pandemic, when they were closed, I saw people standing outside, you know, phoning in their orders and then picking them up just to keep that cafe alive.
Yeah.
They're an amazing company. And when you walk in, there's so much art on the walls. It's just really cheering.
Now, we should mention before we leave, you know, we kind of got out of the bookstore, but Katya D'Angelo, also the owner of the Utter Guys ice cream, the tricycle that rides around Waterbury in season, not out there doing it right now. But that's one more, you know, woman-owned business here in Waterbury.
And also I missed so many because they weren't on Stowe Street.
So right.
I'd like to give a shout-out to PK Coffee, which is right around the corner.
Right.
You should try that, and that's Katrina Veerman. And also at the top of the block, which is actually on Main Street, would be Sunflower Salon and Boutique. That's Kelly
absolutely.
Richardson and Crystal Garfield, both proud Harvard graduates.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
And you kind of touched on them earlier, but just across the street from WDEV, Tabitha Henry and Babe and Gigi. Tell us about them.
Yeah, Tabitha Henry is a really wonderful art supply store, and she's giving, I guess, classes as well. And I think she used to be over by Hen of the Wood, which is a really, you know, fancy restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And when you walk in there, it just really cheers you because there's an awful lot of beautiful art that she's created. And she works with homeowners as well to help them, you know, develop their space as well. And really proud of her and her right-hand person, Caden Shea. That's a flagship store right there in Waterbury, but they have things all over the country.
Mm, that's really incredible.
Real variety, I think, you know, just from a regular cup of joe to a beautiful piece of art on Stowe Street.
All right. Let's try to get a call in. We just have a little over a minute left. Got Nola joining us hi from Ripton. Hi, Nola. Go right ahead.
I'll be brief, but
sure.
I am not a shopper. I don't like to shop. I like to grow my own food, make my own clothes, but I applaud you for what you're doing. I grew up back in New Jersey in the 60s and 70s. We had a little town where we did everything,
mm-hmm.
where we as sisters would go shop for presents for mom and dad at Christmas. There was a kid's store and a women's store and a men's store and a toy store and a fabric store. It was a great little town.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the shopping malls came.
Right.
And the town died. And it wasn't so much the stores we lost. It was just the friendships of people. And that's why I'm so happy that we can do our best to, you know, it's internet and all that now, but the same thing. We don't want to lose those people.
Yeah.
And I'll close by saying I'm currently reading a book. It's called Cairo Bookshelves. And it's about a woman in Cairo, Egypt, who in the 1990s thought, huh, we need more in this town.
Yeah.
And she and her sister and a friend started a bookstore in Cairo, which was no. Everything like that was government run. But they did it.
All right, Nola, I'm going to have to cut you off right there. I love that. And I love that that kind of puts a fine point on what we're talking about here. That mix of, you know, really beautifully locally owned companies right in a downtown area, what it can do. Linda Radke's story is called Women-Owned Businesses on Stowe Street, Waterbury, and you can find it at themontpelierbridge.org. Linda, thank you so much for sharing this wonderful story.
Oh, thanks, Rick. It was great to talk to you.
All right, take care. We're going to go to a break, then come back for open phones till 11. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
All right, this is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. You can always tell when I've got open phones because I sound a little more chill, don't I? First open phones of the week, and you can call in, get things rolling at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. We can talk about those food, toys, games from the way back that you don't see around anymore. We talked about some of those last week. We spoke with children's author and illustrator Jason Chin earlier. If there's a children's book from your youth or one you've read to your kids or grandkids that has become a fave, you can call and let us know. I've got one to share. Also, I've got, believe it or not, a few post office stories. So, again, if you have one of those, something you want to share, maybe you've worked for the post office, been a mail carrier, let us know what that was like. I did a month stint a couple Christmases ago, and if we have time, I'll get to that. I worked in the processing center in Essex Junction for a month at the Christmas holidays, and it is hard work. All right, and of course, open phones mean open topics. You can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. Or email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. All right, let's start with, the favorite children's book. I was in a program called Everybody Wins Vermont a few years ago, and we would read books. When I started, he was in third grade, and I was with him till fifth grade, and still liked picture books, especially when we first started out. And there was one that we loved reading so much together. We read it through, you know, to the time he left at fifth grade. And it is called Dear Mrs. LaRue, Letters from Obedience School. And it's a dog. And he's sent off to obedience school. And he thinks that it was a mistake. He shouldn't be there. The dog's name is Ike. It's one of the funniest children's books I've ever read. Dear Mrs. LaRue, Letters from Obedience School. I think I don't have it. I need to get a copy of that and read it all the time because it always put me in a great mood. Love reading this dog typing out letters from obedience school. All right, let's head to Waitsfield, talk to Jay. Hey, Jay, what's up?
I've got a short article, just a paragraph, actually.
Yeah.
And when we're talking millions of dollars or trillions of dollars, you have no idea really how much that is.
Right.
Okay, this says, if counted out in $1,000 bills, $1 million would be a stack 4 inches high.
All right.
Reach $1 billion, that same stack of $1,000 bills would have to be 358 feet tall. To reach $1 trillion, that stack would stand 67.9 miles high.
Wow. That is staggering.
You never think $1 trillion could be that much more than $1 million.
Yeah.
Incredible. And it's quoted from the Washington Post.
Yeah, and, you know, we sometimes, it's just like, oh, million, billion, trillion.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it you just kind of say, oh, okay, it's the next level up.
Right.
But that level is staggering. And the other thing, I do this all the time, but, you know, when you talk about something needing to be redone, refurbished, rebuilt, whatever, at this time, and
yeah.
I usually just start with $1 million. Right?
Yeah.
Because you can't really do anything. There's smaller scale, projects, but
yeah, sure.
For less than $1 million, that's where we are today. And $1 million to $1 billion is a big jump. Billion
to a trillion is a huge jump.
Oh, Jay. Hey, thanks for opening my eyes. And Jay, are you, I can't remember. Are you a billionaire or a trillionaire now?
I'm a trillionaire.
Of course you are. That's why you know how high that stack is.
Yes, exactly.
Thanks, Jay.
All right, thank you.
Wow, that's eye-opening. And, you don't see the money. It's all on paper. It's all now, digital. It's all just a word. But sometimes, when we're talking about what is being bandied about, is being considered, by governments. Again, they're talking about a massive economy, but nonetheless, they're also talking about massive amounts of money. And that was a great illustration, Jay. Thanks for that. All right, let's see. Should I jump to post office stuff? I think I will. Just several things have come onto my radar about the post office. And this is not a slag on the post office. These are just some different things that have occurred. One was the Elmore General Store, and I'll be there on March 3rd for a WDEV at 90 tour stop. That's a couple away. Next Thursday, I'll be at Ken's Barbershop in Randolph. So Randolph and then on to Elmore. But the Elmore post office is in the Elmore General Store. It looked like they might lose that post office, something they really rely on for foot traffic and really as a center of town. That has been rescinded, or a new contract has been extended. But somebody wrote in to 7 Days a few weeks ago. I've been carrying this around. A woman named Johanna from Montpelier, and she writes, "Thank you for the article on the woes of the U.S. postal system from 2015 to 2019. I was the concierge at a Vermont residential retirement community. The young, upbeat woman who delivered the mail, women were always hustling to get through their own route. And usually someone else's. I learned about their working conditions, switched routes, added routes, when short-staffed, overtime, denied requests for earned time off, and inconsistent hours. I don't think we can appreciate how demanding it is to deliver mail. My daughter lives in a residential part of Istanbul, Turkey, where I can send letters that arrive in 2 weeks or never. I can't send packages. Mail is not delivered to homes through a national system. There are private couriers. I don't think that Americans realize how spoiled we are with the U.S. Postal Service, which is underfunded, short-staffed, and swamped with our internet orders. We can do more than complain. Before it's too late, we can demand that Congress undergird this national treasure. How much do you want to bet that Amazon will buy out the postal system?" Interesting, Johanna. Then let's watch to see how much it costs to mail things and where the mail ends up. And it's an excellent point about, putting a, I don't even know what it is, 55-cent stamp on something, and you can drop it in the mail here in Waterbury, and in a few days it's in Seattle, Washington. And delivered right to someone's house. How do you do that? There was also a story on VT Digger that said that postal workers are being told to give priority on packages over mail. People are wondering, why is my regular mail, you know, coming so slowly and taking so much longer? And that was an explanation. And having worked at the processing center, and I did during the holidays, so there was a lot of packages, but you do kind of prioritize that as a matter of course anyway. And then when you have time, you go and you have other mail to, you know, first-class mail then to kind of sort. And it takes a lot of work. They were always asking for overtime. My shift was from 2 a.m. to 10:30 in the morning. And honestly, by the end of the month that I worked there, my fingertips were numb. My feet were numb. It's very difficult work. Now, I'm going to tell you one more thing, and this came my way as an email last week. I had somebody on from the Vermont Old Cemetery Association a few months ago, and I decided, hey, I'm going to join this, right? And here's what Barry wrote to me last week. Welcome to the Vermont Old Cemetery Association. Your application mailed on November 23rd arrived today, so sometime in January. Forwarded from our previous membership coordinator, Jenny in Hinesburg, it carried further forwarding to Kiev, Ukraine, then to the Maldives, and on to West Haven, Vermont, where Harold Book, cemetery commissioner, who is recovering from broken ribs, recognized my name and sent it finally to me. So I don't know if this is him being facetious or if somehow my letter wound up in the Ukraine and on the Maldives. Anyway, I'm now a member in good standing of the Vermont Old Cemetery Association through next January 1st, and they're happy to have me as a member. But that reminded me of – I don't want to tell stories of my relationships past, but years ago I was dating a woman long distance. I was in Miami. She was in Ohio. And I could tell something wasn't right, and we'd talk on the phone, and I would ask her, well, tell me what's going on. She said, it's in the letter. It's in the letter. And finally, after a week of not getting the letter, she finally told me, I'm breaking up with you. But the letter arrived 6 months later, and I always thought – if I hadn't kind of forced her hand to tell me what was going on, she would have thought I was the biggest denier trying to maintain this relationship for 6 months while the letter never got to me. All right, we got Fred on the line. We'll get to him after the break and then come back for more open phones. 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint and open phones until 11, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. We're discussing food, toys, games from back in the day, probably from our youth. We're discussing postal stuff, children's books that you're fond of. You can also take the conversation wherever you'd like. And we've got the Duke of Newbury next. Fred, where are you going to take us?
Without portfolio.
That's correct. That. Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Hey, so look, this ghost gun business is the biggest joke I've ever heard. The president's wasting his time on ghost guns, and here's the reason.
Tell me.
A ghost gun? Why would a criminal want to pay extra for a ghost gun when he's a criminal already? Doesn't matter. It doesn't make any difference, and he'd rather have a real gun anyways. Doesn't make any difference if the serial number or not. He's a criminal. He's caught with a gun, no matter if it's ghost or not. He's going to go to jail for an extra 5 years. I mean, this is a waste of time. I don't get it. Can you explain it?
Ah, yeah. I love that the Duke comes to me. What am I, like the emperor here?
Yeah, you can be the emperor and I'll be the Duke.
There we go. All right. Thanks, Fred. I can't. I don't know enough about it. That's why I can't. But I'll do some research. You know, sometimes – I don't know if this is what the president is doing, but sometimes as a politician, you do things to show that you're doing something, right? That, you know, it is you in charge and you're making some type of an attempt. I mean, let's talk about the you know, when the oil prices went up, gas prices were rocketing. You know, the president released a number of gallons of the National Reserve. You know, was that done as a gesture to show that something is happening? Prices have stabilized since then. They have, you know, continued to rise. So maybe it did something. But in speaking with Bob Ney, our national correspondent, it was more a gesture of showing that you're doing something. Is that what's happening with ghost guns as we see use of them rising? Let me think or work on that, Fred. I'm not sure I know the answer right now, but thanks for bringing that up. On to Barrytown, and let's talk to Jim. Jim, what's going on?
Hey, well, I have a post office story as a customer.
Excellent. Tell us.
Yeah, back in the 90s, they came out with the Elvis stamp.
Yeah. Didn't we have a vote, too, on whether it was the young Elvis or the older, fatter Elvis?
There was something.
Let's say
going
more
on
Elvis.
There.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So what I did was I got some Elvis stamps. So I stamped an envelope, put my return address on it, and made up a phony address on the front of it. And my hopes was it would come back to my address with a stamp on it, return the sender, and it did.
Brilliant. Oh, you're brilliant. Do you still have it?
That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Well, it got lost. I was involved with a fire that destroyed a building, and you know, a lot of personal stuff perished. But what I did was I had the 45 return to sender, and I had the both of them framed. So I don't know if you can still get Elvis stamps, but it's something cool to do.
Oh, Jim, that was
just
brilliant.
Just make up a phony address, and they'll stamp it return to sender.
Yeah, and, you know, if you still had that, I can't imagine what you could be making on eBay. Since we're talking about probably the most popular stamp of all time, I love to trot out my story about what is probably the least popular stamp of all time, Jim, and I hope you'll indulge me. But do you remember who George Meany was?
George, well, you're going to have to tell me quick.
He was like a labor leader, maybe labor secretary back in the 60s and 70s. Somewhere in, I'm going to say the 80s, I think it was, they did a George Meany stamp, right? Yeah, you know, just like an Elvis stamp, but, you know, this is the less popular George Meany stamp. So I'm staying with a friend, and I'm heading to the post office. And back then, you know, commemoratives, you know, were on a separate sheet. You had to still lick them. And, you know, they had the love stamps and the flag stamps, but I always bought commemoratives. And so I'm going to the post office. She says, hey, pick me up a sheet of stamps, right? So I say, sure. And I get there and looking at their commemoratives, and there's this heinous, you know, face. There's George Meany. He looked mean. And so I thought, oh, George Meany stamps. These are the best ever, right? No one will ever buy these. So I bought myself a couple pages and one for her. And I got home, and Jim, she refused. She refused the stamps. She would not take them. I was stuck with three pages of George Meany stamps, what I like to call the least popular stamp of all time in U.S. postal history.
Well, so you still have some of those?
No, I eventually used them up.
Okay. Yeah.
Writing, I believe, to the woman who eventually sent the Dear John letter that got lost in the mail for 6 months. And it all comes back to that, doesn't it?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting in the post office, you know, I know they're looking for workers here in Vermont, but I was in the Barry post office a couple days ago, and I was in line, and in like within 5 minutes, the line grew to like 15 people because, you know, they're worried about not getting their mail, or they want to mail their stuff to pay their bills, because the post office does have a shortage here in Vermont of employees.
Yeah, there's no doubt.
Yeah. Hey, so that's my Elvis story.
All right, I love it, Jim.
I do have some others, but I'll call you up sometime and share those with you.
All right. The phones are always open. Thanks, Jim.
Bye.
Oh, that's a great one. Return to sender. Oh, man, how did I not think of that? I do have the Harry Potter stamps that came out several years ago. I bought a book and just kept them. I have not used them. But alas, all my George Meany stamps are used up. And I'm pretty sure had I kept them, these 40 years or something, I'm pretty sure that the George Meany stamps of today would be of less value than what I coughed up way back when they came out. Poor George Meany. I'm going to guess I was probably the only person to buy a lot of them. Collectors probably bought them, but I'm probably the only person in America who bought three pages of George Meany stamps, and then I wound up with all three pages. All right, that's it, Danny. Let's put a bow on it. That'll end open phones for today, and our show is wrapped for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivrigan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Feel free to suggest topics or guests, and you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. The podcast is sponsored by the Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I bet you Bill Sayre knows exactly who George Meany is. I'm Rick Sengary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow when I speak with Bob Ney, and we'll also talk about Big Tree Brewing.